Hello and welcome back to another episode of the HRER podcast, where we delve into the world of HR emergencies and scandals. Don't forget to follow and subscribe to HRER on your favourite podcast platform.
Get ready for scandalous stories, lessons learned, and a generous dose of advice for HR professionals for navigating the HR landscape.
Our goal here is not just to entertain, but also to help you learn from the topics we touch on in order to save your business from its own emergency.
Do you think Lionel Messi, like, focuses on his mental health and, like, you know, what he's got going on? And they're like, maybe. And I'm like, he is surrounded by psychologists, by individuals that are there for his mental health, because there is no way that someone can step on that football pitch week in, week out, high pressure, perform at that level consistently without being in a good place mentally. Like, there is no way that that's possible. I think people are very not receptive of it until they hear a human story. And then what I tend to find is, if I've got a room of 16, I've only got to get one of them to share something and then talk about psychological safety, the rest seem to follow. And what I'm now finding is the people that are very negative towards mental health become the minority in that room. And I always say my passion, because of my lived experience, is my biggest strength, right? Because I had what I went through with my dad, that drives me every day to want to help others.
Welcome back to another episode of HRER. Back in the, call it the London studio for the guest series, episode two.
So second of our third guest series this time. Yeah, so for that, we're getting into the swing of it. And today we are joined by Paul McGregor from Everymind. Thank you, Paul, for joining us.
It's a very great introduction. Effects.
Yeah, can we get some claps in the background? Well, we aren't bringing the noise here, but
so,
I digress.
Paul, welcome to HRER. It's great to have you on here. So Paul and I have worked together for a few years now, I think. Well, we've known each other professionally for a few years. Anyway, so we've actually formalised the working relationship more recently. So Paul, you founded the Everymind app. Tell us a little bit about yourself.
Yeah, sure. So I'm Paul, and dad of three, but also huge advocate for mental health. So obviously founded Everymind 4 or 5 years ago, off the back of my own lived experience, you know, some of the challenges that I've had from a mental health perspective. The main sort of life-changing experience was losing my dad to suicide when I was 18, which was, of course, very sudden. And yeah, it took me a long time to talk to one person about that, and then, you know, started to share with more and more people. And Everymind really came about just because I was pretty fed up with the really traditional reactive approach to mental health in the workplace. So yeah, we founded 5 years ago. There's definitely been an evolution, a journey of where we've taken the business, but we, as I say, support hundreds of organizations in different ways, and we see the good and we see the bad. So I'm sure we're going to jump into a lot of that today as well.
So tell me what the app, the platform, does.
So we've pivoted recently, where our core focus at the moment is support for mental health first aiders and champions, and that's what the platform and the app essentially does. So it allows organizations to track impact of those networks, because up until now, they've mental health first aiders, champions have kind of been trained, left and forgotten about. So we allow organizations to track impact through them anonymously logging conversations, which gives the organization ways in seeing what's happening in certain locations across the business as well. But the key focus of the platform is we provide on-demand support to those mental health first aiders and champions. It's based off the clinical supervision model. So if they have a difficult conversation, they can reach out to Everymind, get that sort of support guidance. And we provide regular upskilling, regular development sessions for that group as well. And we work with organizations like Dreams, The Bed Store, you know, Waits Construction, Aston Martin, and different organizations like in you know, financial services and Marshall McLennan, a lot more. All different industries. So we see it all, which is exciting. But yeah, we also do a lot of manager training and workshops still. That's really getting us to connect with colleagues on that more personal level as well.
So in the manager training, I mean, I go out, I do management training, I kind of brush up close to probably some of the stuff that you do and then leave that to professionals. I mean, how have you found the attitudes from some of the people you train? Because I see it when I go out and I talk about things like psychological safety, you know, how we should be talking to people in the workplace, and emotional intelligence. And particularly in the corporate world, I can hear the eyes rolling sometimes in the room, and it takes a bit long to warm them up. I mean, what's your experience been in terms of the reception for some of the stuff that you talk about?
Yeah, I think managers are tricky, especially. It depends on the industry. So I can think about, you know, the financial services industry as an example. Like, when I walk in that room, you know, of course, they're all suited and booted and giving you the eyes and almost like, yeah, extremely busy, right? Yeah, you know, yeah, on their phones or whatever.
He's got slick back hair, Ollie.
Yeah, I've got the quiff, actually. I could probably get away with being a banker, to be honest. But I would say is what I tend to find, because we as an organization, and me in particular, share our experience very early on in that session, that always changes the room. I think people are very not receptive of it until they hear a human story. And then what I tend to find is if I've got a room of 16, I've only got to get one of them to share something and then talk about psychological safety, the rest seem to follow. And what I'm now finding is the people that are very negative towards mental health become the minority in that room. Mm-hmm. So actually now the conversation is more people really wanting to spend a bit more time talking about it. But it's interesting. I get asked questions that I'm thinking, okay, Alyssa needs to answer this. I'm not going there. Because I think that's the thing with managers. It's, you know, I've heard of horror stories where you might not disclose like what someone's shared with you, or you might have made a bad remark to one of your employees from a mental health perspective. And then you go down the whole, obviously, legal route when it comes to that.
I mean, we've done one before. We should tag team in the future. Mm, definitely. Well, I'm going, you out here for a word with me. Yeah. Like, Paul, you can deal with the rest of
them. But I think managers are key, because I saw a stat the other day that I think it was people are more likely now to talk to their managers. I think 76% of people said they would share with their manager about their mental health. I think it was of the same relevance to their partner, I think it was. So, and I think the role of a manager has changed massively. So what we're trying to do is give managers the skills to be able to have those difficult, sensitive mental health conversations. But as you know, there's still that kind of wraparound support that's needed for them as well.
On stats as well, we like stats, don't we?
We do.
I read one on, they were LinkedIn one the other day, so there may not be much truth to it. But like on average, like 50% of people stay in jobs for their managers as well. Like you say, you spend 40 hours a week, sometimes more with these people, don't you? Like look to them for guidance and all sorts of different stuff. So interestingly, I said at the start as well, I did a little bit of research into your company, but I didn't know the whole app sort of setup was to empower managers to sort of offer I thought the app actually offered advice in itself.
Yeah, so the app, so we did launch with an initial app, which was our first product that Alyssa will know about as well, but we've actually decommissioned that from the first of this month. And the reason why we did that is, one, we launched the new platform, which was the support for mental health first aiders, champions, managers. And it was getting really confusing with the other app. But also, you know, and again, we can touch on this maybe a little bit later. The initial idea for the original app was mental health support for all. And it was, you know, in your pocket whenever you need it. Now, this was before every man and a dog had invented a wellbeing app, right? I'm not saying I was the first one to come up with it, but there wasn't that many in the market. And what I found really challenging is it became such a tick box very quickly. You know, if you had 4%, 5%, 10% engagement rate across an organization, they wouldn't look at the people it was helping. They would look at the others that weren't on the app. Yeah. And that was a real tricky point to us. So we decommissioned that version. And as I say, now we're focused on what we call supporting the supporters. You know, the individuals in an organization that are supporting other people, they deserve that support too. So if we can empower and motivate them, it can have that ripple effect out across the organization.
I think that's so important, 'cause where you've got people on the ground, they're going to invariably have more of a lasting impact than perhaps, like I say, an app in your pocket. But the risk of burnout, you know, emotional damage for those people who are doing this, you know, they're volunteers, aren't they? With an element of training, but like you say, you know, where's the support for the support? So it's absolutely, you know, from someone who, you know, is in training managers, I can absolutely see the value of it. And that's, I think, where your gap in the market is, isn't it?
Maybe it's a question for you as well, right? So this is a very great area, right? So if we think about mental health first aid, organizations have used that for years now. So the common way of using mental health first aid, let's take a construction company, which is, of course, they use a lot of mental health first aiders. They may have created a cohort of individuals, trained them as mental health first aiders, put them on the internet, signpost people to speak to them, and haven't created any wraparound support development for them. So that's where we come in. But a lot of organizations don't have us, right? So this is the gray area I'm hearing about.
Yeah.
So if I work for X construction company and you've trained me as a mental health first aider, you're not advertising that people can come and speak to me as a mental health first aider. Let's say that one, I either burn out and I go off sick because I can't handle work and all of these conversations. But two, if I give advice or don't disclose and something happens to that individual, I'm hearing from a legal perspective, there's a lot of grey area around that. I don't know what you think about that.
Yeah, I mean, well, the two elements. So the first, the company absolutely has a duty of care, so that mental health first aider. They're doing this within the course of their employment. They've been trained either by the company or through the company. So whatever the impact on their well-being is, absolutely duty towards them. In terms of the advice that the mental health first aiders are providing, I would say, again, that's within the course of employment. So I think it would take a hell of a lawyer to try and separate the legal duty in terms of the mental health first aider in the company to say to the company to go, they're nothing to do with us, they're doing it independently. So I would say if there was anything that came off the back of that, is that it would be the company that's liable. Well, it drifts out of employment law, but we've got, it's called vicarious liability. So if you're doing something within the course of your employment, it's the umbrella of the company then that takes over in terms of that liability. But you know, I think it's something that companies should be embracing rather than, you know, I've seen it where I've gone in places and I've been doing the training and we brush up to the mental health stuff, but we don't quite go there. And they go, oh, it's okay. We've got mental health first aiders. We just signpost to them. Mm-hmm. And you go, that's where you're stopping though. That's at the point where you go, we've ticked the box. We've done our job. We've signposted. That's all we're supposed to do. And then it's like, okay, but then what happens?
What about them?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. And they also like, I think with organizations, we always say with these individuals, it's quality over quantity and making sure you've got the right people. And I always say, I've spoke to so many mental health first aiders across loads of organizations, and they're all very similar to me, right? They're very passionate because of lived experience. Mm-hmm. And I always say my passion because of my lived experience is my biggest strength, right? Because I had what I went through with my dad, that drives me every day to want to help others. But on the flip side, it's also my biggest vulnerability. So in other words, I can have a conversation with someone today who lost someone to suicide yesterday, and that will really impact me, right? Because it takes me all the way back to that moment 15 years ago.
Which reliving the experience.
You're reliving it, right? Yeah, yeah, so again, like these are individuals that are very passionate because of lived experience, but they're also potentially at risk because they've had their own challenges before as well, and they could be triggered at any time. So that's kind of where we come in, because if that is a conversation you've had, it triggers you, you can now reach out to us straight away and have that debrief, because I have it in the job that I do. So yeah, it's an interesting landscape at the moment, but we're evolving.
And what is it that you do then when you can kind of feel that vulnerability coming in? How do you cope with it?
See, I'm lucky now because obviously I've got people in the team that I can just ring up and say, I've just delivered a workshop, someone's come up to me, sort of shared something, kind of impacted me in a way. And it's just, you know, it's not them, it's not a therapeutic conversation. It's them just listening.
It's talking about it.
Just talking about it. It's like in the same as Samaritans, you will have someone before you leave your shift, you have to have a debrief with, right? Making sure you just talk through your conversations, get it off your chest. And sometimes, you know, it's just that reassurance of, you know, how you handled that conversation was correct. Or if you want to follow up with that person again, here's some resources that you can share with them. So it's just, sometimes I find just sharing how I feel about it helps. And obviously I still have, you know, therapy, and I still have other modalities as well. But in that moment when I've been triggered or something's impacted me, I do find just calling up, you know, one of the people in the team that we've got is a good way of managing that.
Getting the words out of your brain, isn't it, most of the time?
Yeah, just get it out, and like just reassurance, especially from someone clinical of like, no, you handled that well. Like, or maybe like next time, you know, if you feel like this way, maybe try this. But also for me, just creating that space, like go for a walk, you know, whatever it might
be. Mental space, isn't it?
Mental space, yeah especially definitely. If I'm sure you're the same in the work that you do as well. Like if you've had a heavy session, just create some space between yourself and the next thing. Just go for a walk.
I'm a regular at walks around the block, aren't I? Like car garages in the office.
Never your desk.
Never mind. That's true. Just a 10 minutes around the block, innit? Just empty the bread. Don't say it. You've got the wrong idea about
you're me. In customer service. It's like I've had a dreadful conversation. There's only positive conversations with you.
Of course.
I mean, I'm going to ask a very kind of weighted, probably discriminatory question for someone who's in my field, but do you think that men find it harder to talk up, or is that a stereotype? Do you think we've moved past that yet?
I mean, this is a very, very, I would say, controversial topic that I'm exploring a lot more at the moment as well, because after this, I'm literally doing a webinar for one of our clients on do men talk, right? So it's about men's mental health for a construction company. But I've personally been looking into it a lot. I mean, suicide is the biggest killer of men under 50.
One in three, in it, like men have them kind of thoughts.
Yeah, one in three I think one in three individuals have suicidal thoughts. I think that's more of an overall statistic. And again, suicidal thoughts are very different to someone who has the plans and the means to sort of end their life.
Actual capabilities to do it.
Yeah. And it's a very sort of nuanced subject. But yeah, suicide is the biggest killer of men under 50. So like I always say, if you use that as a statistic, I mean, I'm assuming you're under 50, Perry.
You're too kind.
Excellent moisturiser.
Unless it's moisturiser. Right? So when we look at that statistic, it is a statistic, right? But I always say the biggest threat to our lives as we sit here right now is ourselves.
Yeah, yeah, fair.
Right? If you look at it that way, the biggest threat to me as a dad, as a husband, as a brother, as a son, as a colleague, a friend is my own self, right? So again, that is then baffling how little we spend on our mental health when that's the case. If that was a physical illness or a disease or whatever, like we would be doing whatever we could to protect
ourselves. You'd be at the GP, be in the hospital, blood tests.
Exactly. You'd be doing whatever you can to protect yourself from it. But so I feel that, you know, when you look at that statistic, we definitely need to be doing more. When you look at male dominant industries like construction, the suicide rates are also a lot higher. So I think, you know, when you have men with other men in industries where maybe there's not psychological safety that you can talk, it makes it more challenging. But this is my argument a little bit on it now. I feel that, and this is where it might get a little bit controversial, with men's mental health, it's become on the shoulders and the own personal responsibility of the man. Mm. So in other words, men need to talk more. Mm. So it's almost like, okay, we need to do something about it. In comparison to it being an organizational issue or a societal issue, where what can we do differently to help men manage their mental health differently?
How can society adapt to that a bit
and
more?
And again, I think it's purely in my experience, it's, you know, what does it mean to be a man, societal roles, you know, again, not feeling comfortable to talk about it, feeling like you're weak if you talk about it. These have all been things that I've experienced. So it's a very big subject, but yeah, men statistically are impacted by suicide in particular more so than anyone else.
I think we're growing out of it. As I say, we, men as a race, I think we're growing out of it. Like people, men my dad's age, 60 and above, back in their day, it wasn't even a thing, was it?
But I think still in some industries, there is that kind of blockage. And I think it takes one to open up and be vulnerable.
Yeah.
And where I've worked before, there was a very, very strong element of that where there was a male leader who opened up with his vulnerabilities and it did feel like a safer place to talk.
100%.
And I think it does take that still, the one person to kind of go, yeah, we're doing this.
So like so that's a great example. And in organizations, in society, in the pub, whatever it is, that's all it is. It's if you've got one person that can step forward and share their experience or share something vulnerably, it creates an environment where more people feel trusting to do so. So use the example of like, if I go in and deliver to construction workers, I'm like, can I swear on this? I'll say, crapping myself, right? Yeah. A more subtle version of that word.
I swear like a sailor. So
and it's scary because they're all staring at you in high-vis jackets, hard hats, and you're like, okay, I'm going to speak to these individuals for the next 2.5 hours. Banter, like galore already. Yeah. Now, what I tend to find is if I share my experience at the beginning, it's dead silent. Like, you know, it takes someone to interrupt you during you sharing something quite vulnerable. And then the next thing is anyone else in this room going to share? Now, if one person says, I can really resonate to your story, I lost a friend to suicide, or I've struggled with depression or whatever it is, that whole room changes because now one of their colleagues has done the same. So then more and more people share. Not everyone does.
It's pack mentality, isn't it?
Exactly. You've kind of won the room, whereas it's a much more of a tricky situation and session where no one does.
Yeah.
You know, you're trying to get more out of them, but it's struggling. Yeah. And it's the same in the pub. If I go to the pub with my mates and no one is being human, you are just going to keep it surface level banter and everything else. But if one person becomes human, more people feel enabled to
you feel it as well normally. Like, I don't know, I've had it in conversations where like I or someone else will share something and like it, I don't know, it, something switches, like it just becomes a little bit more engaging. Mm-hmm. Like you're looking at each other more and you're talking like it's not, like you say, it's not surface level. Mm-hmm. You've touched on something a little bit deeper. Yeah. And they're the type of conversations that you remember. Mm-hmm. And like have a long lasting effect on you. I think they're really important for people struggling, like you've said.
But I think it comes back to like, we've got to reframe that that's not weakness, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
It's strength, it's courage. Because the reason I didn't talk about my dad for years, like to anyone, and I just kept it to myself, was because you think that you're weak if you talk about it. So now my approach is different. But again, I think if people can realize that then by sharing some of their vulnerabilities, it's courageous, it's strength, they'll start to do it a little bit more. I think people struggle because they think it's seen as a sign of weakness.
I think the very fact that like some people are scared to speak about it should mean that it's seen as brave, but it's not.
It's
largely.
Also interesting that I think if you look at it in the opposite way, so when I share my story and people, I say, what does it mean to talk about your mental health or to be vulnerable? The natural reaction is weak, you know, whatever it might be. And then I say, do you think I'm weak for standing in front of all of you and sharing my story? No, 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 you're courageous.
Yeah. Like,
so it's, we see it as weakness for ourselves, but for other people we see it as courage. Yeah. So it's just changing.
It's weird, isn't it? Though? Mm.
I think I've seen a shift in like my RNLI world. When I first started, we'd deal with some graphic stuff and people would clam up. And since then, like the RNLI's brought in Trim, which the emergency services use. And a couple of years ago, we had a week of just the worst stuff. So I did CPR 3 times in 1 week. We lost 2 casualties and we got one back. I remember we went to the pub at the end of the week and there was very much this kind of the black humour that kind of comes with it. And I remember the guys had left and there was one left and he just turned around and was like, right, we're going to have a real conversation now. How are you doing? You all right? Mm-hmm. And that shift that I've seen in the emergency services world has always been kind of, you know, it's part of the job and we can all kind of have that black humour element about it. And there's people now where they're like, no, we're going to have a real conversation and just make sure you're okay before you leave the room.
Yeah.
And actually, you know, come and talk to anybody. And that's been nice to see that evolution, certainly. And I think the emergency services is a big area where they, you know, those conversations are starting to happen, but there's still a lot of work to be done.
Yeah. And it's when people say about the older generations, you know, didn't really talk about this stuff. They all felt it. They've all like experienced it. But the example that similar to that is we did some work with a police service and someone there was talking about, again, some of the horrific things they see as detectives. And his sergeant was just old school, don't talk about mental health, suck it up, whatever. Yeah. And this guy was saying he was really struggling and you know, was getting into a really difficult point himself. And then all of a sudden he walked past his boss's car and he's in his car sobbing his eyes out on his own. Yeah. And again, it was like, he feels everything, but in front of everyone, he's not going to let anyone see that. And all of a sudden he's in his car sobbing his eyes out because he has to deal with it on his own. So again, it's like now you're starting to create more environments where instead of doing it on your own, you're going to start to bring more people in to help with that.
Yeah.
Share the load, isn't it?
Yeah.
Mm. Share the load.
Mm. So in terms of your own company then, so if you, obviously you set out, you've got to be the best example, haven't you? Because this is the world you're building around yourself. How have you found that to be a challenge? You know, how have you found it then with your own baby, so to speak?
Yeah, I find it really difficult, I think. But also I think it helps me be better at what I do because I can sometimes see, especially from a manager point of view, both sides.
It's another lived experience
of it.
Isn't it?
Yeah. So, but no, I think it's, you know, growing the team has been amazing. Like we've got an incredible team, incredible culture. However, you know, especially in the more trickier situations as a business that, you know, everyone goes through change, you know, the sort of situation financially that the country's in at the moment as well. You know, it's really about how do you get people together aligned in the same way. And of course it's extremely difficult, right? But yeah, we have to set the tone. Although what I tend to find is that, you know, I'm trying to be as open and honest as I can be in front of my team. Like I always say to them, if there's something that I can't share with you because of, you know, shareholders or whatever, I'll say I can't share with you, but I'll also try and share as much as I can with you. And I haven't been afraid of being open and honest and transparent. And you know,
and I suppose you know where you need to go with stuff. You must have seen some horrific practices.
Yeah,
I mean, it's a bit like us with the HRER stuff, isn't it? You know, we see the horror stories. You must see a side of that as well.
Yeah, there's loads of horror stories. I think that in a small organization like ours, it's probably easier to control. But some of the, you know, when you get bigger, some of the things that we see, and I'm sure you see as well, is just how much of a tick box it becomes, right? It's like, well, and I'm sure in like, you know, the law firms and all of that, it's like, well, you know, we're putting on a yoga session.
You're
you know,
or like, we're gonna have some free fruit in the office or whatever it might be. And there's a term called well-being washing, which is like, again, it's like, you know, how much an organization talks about well-being. But we always say well-being is the positive well-being in an organization is an outcome. It's not, it's not the initiatives, right? And again, there was an example of, because I was thinking of some before this session, an organization that had a burnout problem and was like really highlighting that employees were burnt out. So they wanted to run a session on burnout on people's lunch breaks. And again, it's like, well, an hour on someone's lunch break isn't going to cure that. Yeah. So I think people...
And also they're not having a break.
Exactly. I think people are now seeing it in that way. Yeah. Like, to really improve the culture of an organization, initiatives and well-being benefits is just one part of that. Like, you have to look at the whole structure, policies, ways of managing employees. It's a lot bigger than I think people...
I think it's like, we say it a lot, the word a lot, but I think it's part of culture.
Mm. Yeah.
Like, it's the atmosphere in an office or wherever setting you're in. Like, that sets the standard and the tempo for very much how everyone feels.
Yeah.
Mm. Like, I try to make people laugh a lot, obviously, don't I, in the office. I try to do it on purpose just because it makes people happy.
We humour you,
don't we? Yeah, you do. You laugh at my jokes, and I appreciate it. That makes me feel good as well.
Yeah.
But I think it's very much like embedded almost in like your surroundings and the people.
Mm, it is. Yeah. And I think you can't change that overnight. It just takes a huge amount of time. So the example with Dreams, we did a webinar with them yesterday. We started working with them 6 months ago. But Abby, who drives that alongside our support, has done so much, like just really creative, clever campaigns to change the narrative. She's got that buy-in from the top. She's embedded new policies around menopause, around, you know, even periods and more difficult sort of conversations that, again, no organizations will touch sometimes. Mm. And it's this ongoing, you know, process. It's not a, we've implemented EveryMind and everything's going to be fine now. It's, they're doing so much more alongside us, and they're now really starting to see the movement of people feeling more comfortable to talk, people feeling more valued by the organization. So I think that's what we tend to see, is it's an ever-changing, ongoing process. Even with my business, it's ever-changing and ongoing.
I think that's a reflection of human nature, though. Like, our minds are always changing. The way we think is always changing. So you've got to adapt with the times. Question from me as such. It says here you're a mental health author. Is that right?
Oh, yeah.
You've written a book?
I wouldn't... You could call
That's
me
not
that.
The question, but
you,
I just want to
you
confirm
You could call
that.
Me that. I wrote and published a book. I would say it was around... It's before EveryMind, I believe. It's about five, six years ago now. Mm-hmm. And it was more of like just the journey of dad and, you know.
Oh, like your story sort of thing.
Yeah, my story. I originally wanted it to be more of a self-help book for those bereaved by suicide, because it's a very unique form of grief when you've lost someone to suicide. But the publishing company, that was only a small publishing company, was more focused on lived experience. They wanted to turn it into more of a kind of story. So
a novel or something.
Yeah. So, I mean, I don't recommend it anymore because it's 6 years ago and I've probably changed a lot since then. So, but no, I mean, I definitely would like to do something like that again. I found it very therapeutic, the writing process of just
getting it on paper,
getting some stuff down. Yeah, it was good.
The actual question itself is, what advice would you give to someone who is currently struggling with mental health issues?
I think it's very individual. And I think everyone needs to realize that it's very individual. But the key thing that I would always say to people is, all you need is one person, like, you know,
to talk to.
Just one person that you feel comfortable to talk to. And I think sometimes, even in my experience, if you've reached out to your manager or to a spouse or to a friend or a parent, and you've had a very negative response, it can make you close up and armor up even more. And you don't want to do it again. But again, in my experience, like, there are so many other people out there that would be more open to having that conversation with you. So when I say you just need one person, Anne was a lady who helped me massively, like, when I was at my lowest, and she's a more of a holistic therapist. You know, she's in her 80s now, but I still see Anne today, right? You know, 12, 13 years on from the first day that I ever saw her. But it took me a good 3 or 4 meetings with Anne to tell her about my dad and what I was going through and cry my eyes out and all of that stuff. And I always use that as an example in my talks. Now, what's really important is, it still took me 2-3 years to tell my best friend that I was going to therapy. So again, it's not an overnight process if I'm going to tell one person, another person, another person, another person. So all I would say is, Anne was that kind of one person that I had for quite a while. But then I felt more comfortable to tell a friend, another friend, you know, someone else.
That's a very strange point. I had a little known fact about me. I did a little bit of anger management therapy when I was 21, whatever. And I spoke to like an older woman figure. And I found that people probably do find this is true, but I found it easier to open up to someone who I didn't know and didn't know me than like you say, like I couldn't speak to my best mates about it because I was like, I'll be judged. But like you put me in a room with a woman 60 plus, fine. I felt really safe and like secure. I don't know. Is that something you find consistently across people? Are they more likely to open up to someone they don't know?
Yeah, I think so. I think, again, even as a dad of three, like I always know that there's only so much that I can probably offer to my three boys, right? There's going to also be a time and a need for them to have someone else that they want to speak to. So again, like super close to my mum, but again, she's grieving and she's going through what she's going through. So there's a part of me that also doesn't want to burden her with what I'm also going through. So I think you're having someone external. I also think with men in particular, there's research that shows that if it's meaningful, engaging and accessible, it's also more likely to help. So what they mean by that is sometimes a lot of traditional psychological therapies don't help men as much as others. So there's groups like Andy's Man Club, which, you know, every Wednesday, I believe it is, all across the country now, you can come. It's purely just for men to come and someone facilitates an open conversation. You've got golf groups that are linked to mental health. You've got five-a-side football that again's linked to mental health. You've got, you know, motorcycle groups that again linked to mental health. So what people are doing really well now is it's not like, hey, come and talk to me about your feelings. It's, hey, let's go jump on our motorbikes and go for a little drive. However, we're going to make sure we talk about how we feel during this.
There's an activity attached to it.
It exactly. Normalizes it as well, though, because I think with the therapy point, this, I think there is a stigma that comes with, and it's why people don't admit they go. And I remember when I first went and she said to me, why is it taking so long? I said, well, I'm a strong person. I'm told I'm tough. And she goes, what do you think I'm going to do? Turn you to jello? She's like, you think you're going to leave here unable to cope with the world? And it is that it's admitting that there's a weakness or that you need help. And I think it's once you kind of cross that threshold and you see actually that it does strengthen you. And I think there's a lost message there in terms of we still see it as almost that kind of American, you know, view where, oh, they rely on it too much or, you know, it means that there's a weakness. And I think there's definitely an educational piece there where we need more conversations about it.
Yeah. And again, it's the way I sometimes talk about it to managers that say, oh, don't believe in mental health. I always say, well, think about like the best footballer in the world at the moment or something like that. And they might say, oh, it's, you know, Lionel Messi or whatever. And then I'll say
good
to
answer.
Them, yeah, good answer. And then I'll say to them, do you think Lionel Messi like focuses on his mental health and like, you know, what he's got going on? And they're like, maybe. And I'm like, he is surrounded by psychologists, by individuals that are there for his mental health, because there is no way that someone can step on that football pitch week in, week out, high pressure, perform at that level consistently without being in a good place mentally. Like there is no way that that's possible. So again, it's the same in a workplace. How can you expect to manage all the pressures, all the emails, all the whatever's going on at work, but then also at home without being in a good headspace? It's like impossible. So I think the challenge with maybe in your situation and in my situation and maybe yours as well is we go to therapy when there's something drastically wrong, like when we're almost broken.
Yeah,
we're like broken and we need some help drastically. Whereas again, it's like, how do you start just using it more proactively?
And maintenance, isn't it? Rather than taking your car to the garage when the wheels have fallen off, or me when there's an engine management light and a tyre light and a something else light. The first sort of, no, just look after it.
Yeah.
Fine.
It's hard to do though, right?
Yeah. So Paul, thank you so much for coming on. It's been such a good conversation. I feel like the time's really flown on this one.
I've not really looked at this. We've just sort of chatted amongst ourselves. Yeah. It's been lovely, mate.
Our lovely producer, Dawn, who does so much work in helping us with the framework, and we've just totally ignored all the preparation and the questions.
Your questions are great, Dawn. I'm just going to put that out there.
So, Paul, if we were going to have another guest on, who do you think we should have on the HRE?
Oh, that's a very...
Who would you recommend the hot seat? No pressure.
There's a guy called Josh Connolly, who I would recommend.
Okay.
And the reason why I'd recommend Josh is he does do some stuff around resilience in the workplace, but he's also doing a lot around toxic parents at the moment.
Oh, okay. Cool.
Childhood trauma.
Okay.
Josh is got long hair, like very spiritual as well, but he's doing some amazing work. So Josh Connolly, or I haven't actually spoke to, actually, I'll give you another one, Amelia from Suicide & Co. Okay. So Suicide & Co, I'm a trustee of, they're doing some amazing work in the suicide bereavement space. And again, we know with organizations when they're impacted by the loss of someone to suicide, it's huge, hugely impactful. So Amelia is doing some amazing work with that charity as well. So they're the two.
Oh, thank you.
Spot on.
Well, thank you so much for tuning in, listening, all the comments, even the trolls. We love you.
Even the trolls, yeah.
Thank you so much for everyone who has pushed us to number 21. I think we are now.
I think
we've
it's
climbed again, number 21 in the 21, HR in the HR charts. We're really enjoying the guest series. If you've got anybody that you would like us to interview, please don't hesitate to drop us a message or reach out on our socials at Heroes. And Ollie, over to you.
Yeah, like, comment, subscribe, and we'll see you next time. Thank you.
Until next time, we're your hosts signing off from HRER. Take care of your HR and may your workplace be disaster-free. Before we go, a big thank you to you for tuning in and don't forget to subscribe. If you have your own ER stories or suggestions for future episodes, reach out to us at Heroes or on social media or even HRER at heroes.co.uk. As we navigate the maze of workplace blunders, remember that no organisation is perfect, but by sharing these stories, we can all work towards creating healthier, happier and more productive workplaces.